This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, C. Everett Koop, was the Reagan administration's Surgeon General. In Dr. Koop's new memoir, he writes about his behind-the-scenes conflicts with the Reagan administration on abortion, AIDS, and smoking. Koop became the Surgeon General as he was preparing to retire from Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, where he was the chief surgeon. In hindsight, writes Koop, it is clear the Reagan people saw the Surgeon General's job primarily as a means of advocating their social agenda, especially pro-life and family issues. They knew Koop was an evangelical Christian and an ardent opponent of abortion. But Koop proved to be an independent thinker. His advocacy of sex education and condoms to stop the spread of AIDS alienated many of the conservatives who had first supported him, but it made allies of some liberals who had been his opponents. Koop told me he realized early on in his tenure that the Reagan administration expected him to promote its social agenda.
I would be invited to go over to the White House to talk to visitors. Visitors pour into the White House all the time, groups of 10 to 300. But I was always asked to talk about issues having to do with the family life in America, with abortion, with where our concerns were about mounting cost of health care and euthanasia. Never asked to talk about the current health problems in the United States was what I was spending my time doing.
You think that the Reagan administration chose you for Surgeon General because of your position on abortion, but you say you didn't want to use your position to crusade on abortion, even though you were strongly opposed to abortion. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you want to use the position to crusade about abortion?
Well, you know, there's a line in an old hymn that says, "What more can he say?" And that's what I felt. I felt that I had been speaking on this since 1973 and a little before. I had made three of a five film series with Francis Schaeffer. We had taken that all over the country. And it just seemed to me that I wasn't called to Washington to be just a pro-life Surgeon General. I guess when I went to Dick Schweiker and said to him on the first day I was there, first full day I was there, I said, "I just want you to know that I do not intend to use this job as a pro-life pulpit." He looked both surprised and relieved, and I don't know how to interpret that. But knowing him as I do now, he probably would feel as uncomfortable as I felt to be there for a single purpose. And so it just worked its way out from there.
President Reagan asked you to prepare a report on the adverse mental and physical effects of abortion on women.
He didn't say adverse. He just said the effects. Health effects of abortion on women. But the implication was, in the context which he said it, it included the problems of post-abortion syndrome, so-called.
So do you think he already knew what he wanted the conclusion of this report to be?
Well, I know exactly how the report came about. One of his young staffers said, "Mr. President, if you really want to do something about Roe v. Wade, get the Surgeon General to write a health report on the effects of abortion on women. And it'll be so powerful and overwhelming that it will overturn Roe v. Wade." Well, I can't believe President Reagan, politician he was that naive. And I rather suspect, as I think I said in my book, that the president was throwing a bone to the pro-life people. I was the bone.
So what did you tell the president?
Well, another interesting thing I think that people will find in this book, that presidents talk to you through the press. I never had one word with the president before or after this whole affair on abortion. He said it. It was reported in the press. And then, of course, his staff talked to my staff, and my staff told me what my marching orders were. And so I set out to do exactly what he wanted. And I found that there were 225 papers written on the health effects of abortion mentally. We all knew that if you do a certain number of abortions, there'll be a certain number of physical problems. There'll be a few deaths. There'll be a few cases of perforated uterus that are recovered. Not many studies have been done on long-term things such as sterility, because it's very hard to say. If a woman has an abortion in 1980 and is sterile in 1982, you might like to say it was abortion, but you can't prove it. See, that was my whole problem. I was not about to say anything in a report that bore the imprimatur of the Surgeon General. And it's important that you understand that I said title and not my name, because I could never have accomplished what I wanted to and what I did in Washington if I hadn't been preceded by a bunch of people who didn't make fools of themselves. And so I was not about to do that over the issue of abortion. I decided, after reading these papers and working with my staff, that it's practically impossible to write a design for an experiment on this subject without bias. So after pursuing this matter and being convinced in my own mind and knowing how the pro-life people had pushed the president into this kind of a decision, I wrote him a letter. I worded it very, very carefully, and what I said was that there was no evidence either way about the health effects of abortion on women that I could defend scientifically or statistically. Now, the bombshell was that when that was reported by one of the wire services and picked up by the networks, that's not what was said. It said Dr. Koop could find no ill effects of abortion on women. Didn't say that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, who has just written his memoirs called Koop. You say at a certain point you started to have second thoughts about a lot of people in the anti-abortion movement, and you started to become disturbed by a lack of integrity and an absence of scholarship in pro-life publications.
Mm-hmm. On both sides, really.
On both sides.
Yeah, both sides.
I'm wondering, from the perspective of where you stand now, if you have any reservations of about the books or film that you did on abortion, if there's anything that you would like to change in that. And I guess what I'm thinking of specifically, and forgive me if I don't get this right because the film was a long time ago, but I vaguely remember there was a scene in the documentary that you did about abortion where there's hundreds of dolls.
A thousand dolls.
Mm-hmm. With their limbs kind of torn off. Yes?
No, you're getting two things mixed up.
Okay.
I'll tell you what they were.
Help me out.
Well, we wanted to make one point about the number mm-hmm. of abortions. So we had 1,000 dolls, and they were out on the Dead Sea because they float so much above the water. They're lying on a lake. And we said that each one of these dolls, 1,000 of them, represent a tremendous number, another 1,000 babies who have been aborted last year, because we had 1 million abortions a year in those days. And the other one that you're thinking about, I was trying to get across the idea that defective babies now are looked upon only for the defect you can see and not for the innovative, creative, loved, and loving person he or she could become. And what I had were dolls coming down an assembly line with an inspector throwing away anyone that had something missing, like a leg or an arm. It was to make a point. It's kind of a living cartoon. So I haven't changed my mind at all about those things.
The doll Holocaust scene, mm-hmm. you know, on the Dead Sea was criticized by a lot of people for being a kind of sensationalist.
Sure,
way
I was trying to make it sensational. I wanted people to know. I mean, we don't understand numbers. When someone says 1 million babies were aborted last year, I don't just think of the 1 million fetuses that were dropped in buckets. I think of the 1 million families that had to go through this unbelievable, painful decision, no matter what it is. 16-year-old girl in school, 14-year-old girl in school, pregnant, not wishing to be, and not planning to be. No matter what course she takes, it disrupts her life forever. It disrupts the family. It disrupts the extended family, the community, the church, everybody. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so interested in having the numbers of abortions reduced and why I think both sides could get together, come to some kind of a political compromise that would not be a moral compromise. And the whole point of that is that a large segment of the pro-life movement equates contraception with abortion, and they are quite different. And when you set up a principle and say, we're talking about pregnancy, we will not let you prevent it, and we will not let you get rid of it after it's happened, you have put a segment of women into an unbelievable bind.
Former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, and he's just written his memoirs. One of the subjects you spend a lot of time on in your memoirs is AIDS and how you tried to handle that and how the Reagan administration handled it. This is an area where, like with abortion, you surprised some people, made new friends, made enemies out of some old friends. You say that you weren't allowed to speak publicly about AIDS in your position of Surgeon General until Reagan's second term. What were the restraints and how were they imposed on you?
I don't really understand it, even to this day. It wasn't that I was... You have to understand how it was presented to me. These are the things you're covering now. We'll take care of these. So that means if you're doing that, we're doing this, you're not doing AIDS. The way I found out about it was that when I would go to an interview like this, someone from the Public Affairs Department would go ahead of me and say, don't ask Dr. Koop any questions about AIDS. Now, I don't know whether they thought I was going to have a tantrum or go into shrieking hysterics about it or try to impose a morality that might not be that of the television station or the government. I don't know. But it all came to a happy conclusion. And I look back on it and say without any question, if I had been asked to be the spokesperson about AIDS in the very beginning, mm-hmm. I would never have had the impact I had when I came. So that by going through that period from 81 to 85 and saying, what in the world is going on? And then suddenly having someone saying, I'll tell you what's going on, I'd had a much better impact than if I had been a constant voice during those years.
Well, you're of the opinion, I think, that the Reagan administration really didn't want AIDS addressed at all early on. They saw the Just Say No campaign against drugs as a win-win situation, you say, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but speaking about AIDS was a no-win,
situation. Right.
Why was that a no-win situation?
Well, I think, again, you have to recognize constituencies. And although the conservative wing of the Republican Party is not large, it does have influence, and it has elected presidents, and it makes itself known very quickly when something comes up. The controversy right now about whether or not people coming into this country should be HIV positive or negative is being fought largely as a political battle behind the scenes by conservatives. I can't really believe that Mr. Bush, in his heart, believes that that's what you ought to do, because I'm the one that taught Mr. Bush much of what he knows about AIDS. So I know he has a very thorough understanding of it. And to arrive on the scene with a piece of paper that says, look, I'm HIV negative, let me in your country, it's without value unless you'd lived with that person every minute for the past 6 months. Because whatever his sexual behavior was, his ability to use and abuse drugs, he might be at the moment infected, more infectious than he ever will be again in his life. But you have the false premise that he's got a piece of paper that says he's okay.
Well, you say that a lot of Reagan officials were biased against homosexuals and they tried to stir up hostility toward AIDS victims. I'd like to hear some examples from what you saw and heard behind the scenes of that.
Well, I give one in the book where I was invited to lunch by a senator. And some of these people I've been talking about were there. The people they brought with them were people who despise homosexuals. I think I like to interrupt and say we need a new word in our language, because to describe people like that as homophobes is incorrect. These people are not afraid of homosexuals. They hate them. And on the occasion I'm talking about, the senator, who was the host, found out who the guests would be, and he didn't even come to the luncheon, but sent one of his aides. And I sat there and heard these diatribes, which were primarily against homosexuality rather than the disease we're talking about. And I just faced them down with everything that they said with scientific fact. They all shut up and they all went home. Those same people eventually found their way right into the Domestic Policy Council of the White House and told them all the same things. And there's an occasion when I was present at a task force of AIDS interested people, and one of the White House representatives said, how do we know that you're right and these other people who tell us it comes from toilet seats are wrong? Maybe we ought to try it their way. From a government official sitting in a domestic policy office of the White House, it's almost inconceivable.
I'm wondering if your religious views predisposed you against homosexuals.
Let me give you a funny answer.
Yeah.
If I don't tell you, it doesn't really matter, because
that's an interesting answer.
I didn't ever let my religious views in any way influence what I said as a public servant mm-hmm. to you. And on the contrary, having taken an oath to uphold the Constitution and do a lot of other things, including my job, which was to inform the public, the first thing that I did was to make it very clear how AIDS was really transmitted, how it was not transmitted. And then I followed up by saying that I was the Surgeon General of all the people, and not just the people whose lifestyles pleased some members of Congress, and also said we were fighting the disease and not the people who had it. So I staked out my claim pretty carefully, and I adhered to that. But I followed it up when I found that many religious broadcasts in this country were indeed fomenting this idea that it's homosexuals that we must be afraid of, not the disease they have. I went to the National Religious Broadcasters, representing practically everybody on television or radio in this land. And I said, if you are one who believes on the basis of your religion that homosexuality and homosexual behavior is a sin, then I know that the same source that told you that has told you to separate the sin from the sinner. So you ought to go out and take care of a patient with AIDS as a sick person. You don't ask him how he got his disease or what his personality was. You just take care of his problem.
You released the Surgeon General's report on AIDS on October 22nd of 1986. Mm-hmm. You emphasized the importance of abstinence and monogamy, but you also emphasized mm-hmm. sex education. Mm-hmm. Now, in the report, you wrote, most Americans are opposed to homosexuality, promiscuity of any kind, and prostitution. You were asked to revise that.
I was asked by a member of the White House staff to change that to all.
To all Americans oppose homosexuality, promiscuity,
I said,
and prostitution.
I said, I can't. He said, why not? He said, because all Americans aren't. Even if there are 10 people who are pimps and they're making their living on prostitution, that's not all people. So I can't say because it's wrong.
Was it kind of embarrassing for you to be in the position of having to talk about sex education and sexual acts and the use of condoms? I think a lot of people are not used to speaking about these kinds of things in public, and you were in the position of trying to help Americans come up with language that they could be comfortable right. using mm-hmm. in public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I used to preface some of the things that I said in those days by, ladies and gentlemen, it is not easy for this elderly gentleman, married for more than 50 years, with 7 grandchildren, to talk to you about a word that you've kept in the closet for all of your life. But we are dealing with people who will not be abstinent, who will not be mutually faithfully monogamous, and if they persist in their behavior, we have to tell them to protect themselves. That is my job as your Surgeon General. Now, the only thing we have to offer as protection is a condom. But I hasten to add, anybody who uses it, it is not 100% safe. But as a rubber gadget, it's more safe than the people that use it, at least more reliable.
The term exchange of bodily fluids
is such rubbish. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, I don't know how you exchange bodily fluids with the possible exception of a very wet kiss.
So did you advocate the use of that term? I can't remember.
I never used it.
You never used
never
it?
Never used it. Mm-mm. There's certain things that I know I never said. That's one of them.
Because you thought it was a...
Well, it's not an exchange, you know.
It was always very vague, too. What?
Yeah, that's
what
right.
Do we mean by that?
There was a people who would not be willing to use the word semen. That's all that was. And they didn't have to say it any other way. They didn't say deposit, because then that let women off the hook, because they weren't the depositors, you see.
What's your assessment of the damage that might have been caused by the Reagan administration having waited so long, having muzzled you in speaking about AIDS?
It's an imponderable.
Yeah.
But I do say when I'm talking about this publicly, reviewing the history of AIDS, say that in the early political days when everybody was fighting a political agenda instead of a health agenda, mm-hmm. that valuable time was lost and lives were lost. But I have no idea of knowing how many.
Do you think that the Bush administration is still fighting a political agenda instead of a health agenda?
I think Mr. Bush is still plagued by the conservatives who beat on him anytime an issue comes up that could be loosened a little bit. It's absolutely ridiculous for this country to close its doors to AIDS scientists and have to cancel next year's international meeting on AIDS and have it shipped from Boston to someplace in Central Europe. I mean, that's not leadership.
I think one of the dilemmas you had to wrestle with through your years as Surgeon General is how does someone in a position like yours deal with what their own religion tells them when they are also in a leadership position in a pluralistic society where not everybody shares the same religious views. So what were some of the ways you resolved that for yourself?
Well, let me put it very bluntly. My religion, my ethics, my morals are probably what you approve of most in me, even though you don't know it. Because Washington is composed of substance and process. Now, the substance is what I did, and that could be called my conclusions. You may not have liked my conclusions, but if you watch the process that I used to get there, it was the outworking of my ethics and my morals, which said, I have to be honest, I have to do this with integrity, I am a public servant, I am not entitled to the luxury of choosing my clientele.
I found your memoirs to be pretty candid. On the other hand, I don't know what it is that you're not telling us. Is there a lot that you're still holding back for reasons of diplomacy or for protecting people who you respect, even though you disagree with the way they handled something?
No, I don't think so. I went through that book to be very careful that I didn't let any personal feelings I have about somebody inadvertently bias what I said about them. That's not what the book is for. I don't think anything is to be gained by that. I think I got across what I wanted to get across, and that was the answer most people ask me, how did you do it?
Well, thank you very much for talking with
Pleasure.
Us. My guest has been Dr. C. Everett Koop, former Surgeon General during the Reagan administration. He's written his memoirs. The book is called Koop, The Memoirs of America's Family Doctor. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.